Today is Sunday, February 14th, 2021. This is part 4 of a Grand Canyon oral history with Jim Haggart, H-A-G-G-A-R-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Tom. How are you?
Well, very good. Thank you. In our last interview, we left off in 1975, and you were at the University of Arizona. Can you pick that thread up?
Sure, I'd be happy to. It's a, you know, it's a great opportunity having these discussions with you to reestablish these points in my life growing up. You know, key times, and so a lot happened in the mid '70s to me, and with as far as my outdoor activities went. And it was about this time when we started getting a little more serious about our Grand Canyon climbing, and up until that time, you know, I was kind of like restricted to the knowledge I had was essentially what I found in Butchert's books, Grand Canyon Treks, and you know, what we could glean off of the 1 to 62,500 topo maps, because of course the more detailed maps of today weren't available then, And so it was kind of limited, and, you know, we'd talk to people, and nobody really knew too much about it. I wasn't in touch with any of the Flagstaff people, like Jim Ullman, at that time. So, you know, we didn't know what was going on with them, and we're just kind of down there in southern Arizona. And so fortunately, I was doing climbing with some friends, and I found in the Special Collections library, part of the library at the University of Arizona, that there was a copy of Butchert's field notes there.
Oh.
And, yeah, this was really a surprise to me, you know. And of course, it was all his typed pages, right? And, you know, you had to go in. It was really it was kind of – well, it was restricted. You could only go in there, and you could only you know, they didn't – we didn't really have photocopiers capability then. I mean, there was mimeographing and whatnot, And of course, you couldn't check these things out. You had to review them in the library. So I would go in there, and quite honestly, Tom, I transcribed word for word several scores of pages of Harvey's notes, you know.
Wow.
And if you've ever looked through his complete set of notes, you know it's – well, I've got you know, the subset that I've got here is 4 bound volumes of notes, you know, each of them about 250 pages thick. So it's a tremendous resource.
He was good at filling a piece of paper with solid text.
He was. I always wondered how he did that because, you know, he would come back from his hike on Sunday afternoon in time to play bridge with his wife and friends, and then he'd be teaching the next morning, I assume, at in the math department at NAU. And then I can just see him sitting in his office between classes, sitting down at the typewriter and, you know, firing all this stuff off. But it's week after week after week he did that. It's just a tremendous effort, you know.
He would fire it off, and then he would clearly send a copy down to the U of A.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I think their copy was the U of A's copy, I think, was from somebody else, maybe Doc Marston or somebody that had copied that and then passed that along to the U of A. I'm not sure exactly what, you know, the genealogy of the notes in Arizona were, but it was a gold mine for me, you know, and I spent many hours in there when I should have been studying statistics and whatnot, looking at these notes and copying them over. But, you know, they provided a lot of valuable information about routes. And so, you know, I guess I used that and of course, my growing interest in rock climbing at the time. We were climbing in Southern California a lot. I think we might have talked about that a lot. I'm sorry.
Going out to Joshua Tree.
Southern Arizona.
Yeah. Okay. Yep.
Quite a bit in the Catalinas and a little bit in the Rincons and down south of there and in the Chiricahuas and then a couple of trips to California. You know, I went to Yosemite. It was in Talkeets, and not doing anything, you know, nothing rigorous. These weren't like first ascents in Yosemite or anything like that. They were just they were just but solid climbs, you know, with lots of leading, and it was a lot of fun. And that was at the time when we were transitioning from pitons to nuts, you know. And so, you know, we got, especially on the cracks of Yosemite, you get a lot of fabulous practice with nuts at the time. So it was a lot of fun learning all that. And, of course, most of that was on granite, you know.
Right.
And there's very little of that in the Grand Canyon. And it's much more poorly lithified rock. And so it was a little intimidating to think about climbing in the Grand Canyon, but I knew from my experience and from reading that some of the units, like the Coconino, if you got good rock, good sections of it, could be really, you know, compact and tough and hard and really beautiful to climb on. So so anyways, you know, after one of our trips Yosemite, my friend Chris and I came back, and with our friend Doug Rickard. You know Doug.
Yep.
And Doug went. He continued down to. I don't remember exactly the chronology on this, but we split up, and Doug went back to Phoenix. Chris and I went to the North Rim, and we joined a fellow named Larry Treiber there. And I don't know if you've heard of Larry, but
how do you
spell
Larry's last name?
T R E I. B-E-R.
And Rickard is R-I-C-K-A-R-D?
Yes.
Thank you.
That's right.
Okay,
so
you met Larry on the North Rim?
Yeah, Chris and I met Larry on the North Rim. And Larry had owned a climbing backpacking shop, co-owned it, in the Phoenix area. His partner was a guy named Suri, Tom Suri. And,
how do you spell Tom's last name?
Bill Suri, I'm sorry. S-E-W-R-Y. Suri. It might be S-E-W-R-E-Y. And they both passed away, unfortunately.
Okay.
But the Desert Mountain Sports was the climbing hub for Central Arizona. Now, Dave Baker had the Summit Hut down in Tucson, but Desert Mountain Sports was the place in the Phoenix area, and Larry was an exceptional climber, a very competent climber, put up a lot of first ascents in Granite Mountain up by Prescott, and also in the Phoenix area, you know, and so I really enjoyed climbing with him. So we got together, the three of us, Chris Beal, Larry, and myself, on the North Rim, and we said, let's go climb something. And so I had been scoping out unclimbed peaks, you know, and I knew that Brady on the North Rim hadn't been climbed, and it was a Coconino Butte, so it's down south of Mount Hayden, and east of Kibbe Butte, and we didn't really know how to get down there, but we figured we could find a way through the upper cliffs, and so, you know, we spent a really wonderful day scoping that out, and then the next day we actually went down and did the climb, the three of us. And it was just a really exciting time for me, because I think that was one of the first ascents that I did in the canyon. And first recorded ascent. When I talk about first ascents, I'm very cognizant of the fact that our ancestors, First Nations peoples and Aboriginals may very well likely have climbed a lot of these summits.
You bet.
First recorded ascent. So
yeah.
That's what I refer to, first recorded ascent. And if there's no cairn on top, you feel a little bit more confident, you know, thinking that you're the first one up there in a long time, et cetera. But this was really neat because it was a moderate difficulty climb on this beautiful sandstone, you know, and it entailed everything. It entailed finding a route off the rim, down through all that brush in those North Rim ravines, and then walking out on the beautiful open shale slopes of the Hermit out to the butte there, and then, you know, finding a way up these gorgeous white sandstone blocks and to the summit. And we had, the three of us had a great time. And so that only took us 2 days, right, to scope out the descent off the rim and then do the actual climb. It was fairly quick, and nothing really difficult there. It was just that it was a gorgeous climb in a remote wilderness setting, you know, with just the level of difficulty that you really got jazzed about it. So, and so then, unfortunately, Chris had to go back down south to Tucson or Phoenix. I don't remember exactly where, but Larry and I stayed on, and we thought we would climb Mount Hayden.
Okay.
Now, I don't know if you know where Mount Hayden is, but it's off of Point Imperial. So it's named for the senator, right, of Arizona in the early 1900s.
Carl Hayden,
and,
yeah.
Carl Hayden. And so Mount Hayden is a beautiful pinnacle that has been many times on the cover of Arizona highways. And it's basically got four sides to it, and that gradually tapered to a pool table flat summit. It's incredible how flat the summit is, but of course it's just a bedding plane at the contact between the Coconino and the Toro Weep, but the sides are very very high angle. Like the easiest side would be the southeast side, and that's probably about 70 degrees, you know, overall average angle. So it's just a very beautiful peak, and it had been climbed. It had been climbed first in the late 50s, and
who climbed it in the late 50s? Do you know?
Yeah, it's a couple of guys from Southern California.
Ah.
God, who was that? I'm actually trying to look it up. If you have the time.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I should know. I should know at the top of my head, but. Yes, Chuck Sigler and Rick Petrillo.
How do you spell their names?
Oh, Chuck Sigler, S-I-G-L-E-R.
Okay.
And Rick Petrillo, P-E-T-R-I-L-L-O.
Thank you.
And I made a mistake there because I said it was in the late 50s, and I was thinking of Signella about when I said that, because Sigler and Petrillo climbed Hayden in 1969, so a fairly recent ascent. And anyways, you know, I don't even think Larry and I knew all these details at the time. We knew it had been climbed, and we just wanted to go climb it. And we knew that the standard route, so-called standard route, was on the southeast face. And again, it's one of these examples of an experience where everything works out perfectly, right? You know, we left our car at the Point Imperial, and you drop off the rim there immediately and scramble down through these really brushy ravines in the Kaibab, and eventually down through the Coconino, and then you can walk the slopes on the Hermit, which are fairly open, out to this beautiful, imposing summit. And I remember it was a cool day in mid-May when we were up there. I think the park had just recently opened on the North Rim.
Right.
And we walked around to the southeast face, and you know the gentle wind is kind of blowing through the ponderosas that are down there, and it's a tremendous view looking down onto Nanqui Valley and the Palisades of the Desert and then the reservation to the east. You know,
right.
It's just phenomenal. And it was just one of those perfect, magical days. I remember feeling that, you know, I can remember so vividly the wind blowing my hair, you know, and ruffling my shirt under the gear sling that I had, and just climbing up these cracks and thin, relatively thin face moves, and finding perfect protection, and it was just a fabulous day, and I hadn't climbed a lot with Larry in central Arizona, because he was a much better climber than I was, and he he focused on more difficult things. But we had a great time. It was a great, at least I did, fantastic experience, you know. And then we pull up on the top, and you pull over the top of it, and you're literally on this pool table. And it's just an immense acreage that's totally flat, you know. And so it's pretty neat. And we found the cairn and put our names in there, and then wrapped off. And it was just one of those perfect magical days, right?
Nice.
So those two climbs really whet my appetite at that point for climbing in the canyon. And I think at that point I really started to focus on going after summits, you know. And in particular, things that hadn't been climbed yet. And there were a lot at that time that hadn't been climbed yet. Because I didn't know that, you know, the guys in Flagstaff, like Jim Ullman and Jim Kirschfink, were also starting to climb summits, right?
Right.
Around that time. Because neither of us knew of each other. And you know, word didn't travel fast. There was no internet. And unless you happen to run into these people or maybe talk to somebody in a climbing shop in Flagstaff, you know, you wouldn't know any of these details until you get to the summit and there's somebody's already been there 2 weeks
and you're reading,
before, right?
Who are these people? And, yeah,
and that happened to me a couple of times when I went up to do what I thought was the first ascent, and I found out Jim Ullman had beat me there by 2 weeks, but no problem, you know. It's just kind of funny, you know, to hear that other people were also interested in this, or to, you know, to learn that right from
right.
these records. And so let's see, in 75, I actually, you know, in preparation for today's discussion, I kind of put together a chronology of things that, you know, for me are fun to talk about, highlights.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of referring to that. I don't know if that's cheating or
not. No, it's not cheating at all.
Okay. And if I'm spending too much time on anything, you know, you should let me know and we can move it along. But
so far, so good.
Okay. you know, I wasn't attracted to river running to the same level that, you know, obviously many people are. And I don't know what that was. I mean, it could be because we lived in Phoenix, you know, you didn't have access to the local community in Flagstaff, which is, you know, was always planning a trip. I remember hearing this all the time that so and so had a private permit to do something, you know, to do a river trip, and and besides, on top of that, I was more interested in climbing, right, and summiting and hiking, and so you know, at that time, a river trip was seen as much more limiting because you would be stuck on the river. Now, I know you have worked out, and other people have worked out fantastic trips where you have a lot of opportunity built into your river trip to explore. But that didn't seem like it was feasible at the time. I think when people did river trips, it was just, let's get down it, do it right, and, you know, survive and have a good time on the water. And but I did get invited on one trip that Doug put together. And Doug Rickard.
Uh-huh.
And that was in 76.
Okay.
And I'm not sure how many river trips Doug had done, but it was with people in central Arizona.
Okay.
Ross Clement, who was one of the leaders of the Arizona Mountaineering Club.
How do you spell his
name? Ross, R-O-S-S, Clement, C-L-E-M-E-N-T.
Okay.
And I know he was, he did a number of river trips down like the San Juan and the Salt River in central Arizona.
Yeah.
That was another favorite destination when the water was high enough, right?
Right.
And another fellow named Mark Brown, who was a climber in the club too, and he was doing river running. And so they were getting permits once in a while to get down the Colorado, and Doug was a good friend of mine at the time, and he invited me on one of these trips. And I think this was the first time he had put together his own boat. So it was kind of a big experience for him.
Yeah.
And it was just a rubber boat. It wasn't a sophisticated dory type, wooden type boat.
Uh-huh.
But it was, you know, I guess when I say it, he put together his own boat, I meant his frame,
right?
That would fit in the pontoons. And so he invited me down, but because of the timing of the trip, I remember I couldn't you know, go on the whole thing. I was going to school, and I, you know, was working, and I don't remember exactly what it was, but I could only participate for like a number of days, right? And I think they were planning like 3 weeks total. But he said, come along. And I said, well, I could meet you someplace.
Mm-hmm.
How about that? I meet you on the river.
Okay.
And he said, well, tell me where you can meet me. And I said, well, you know, so he gave me his schedule, he thought they were going to be camping each night. And I looked at, you know, where I might be able to join them.
Yeah.
Right. And so I said, well, how about at Quaggan, the mouth of Quaggan Creek? And because I thought I can get down there, you know, from the North Rim.
Right.
I can get down Quaggan Valley, and I can, you know, meet them on that day that they're going to be at Quaggan. So, you know, and he said, okay, fine, yeah, let's do it, right?
And then were you thinking, I'll go with them to, like, Phantom and hike back out? Because your vehicle, if you're coming in Quaggan, K-W-A-G-U-N-T, you've got to start on the North Rim, which means your vehicle's over there.
So that's right.
I'm just trying to think about how that all, you had to work out that logistics, right?
Yeah, that's right. And so the plan was that I would leave them at Crystal.
Oh.
Okay, and then where I actually left them at Tuna, but I hiked out Crystal.
Okay.
And then up to Teo Point, and then I followed the roads all the way back to the head of the Kaibab, and then there's the what's the name of that trail? I'm not sure. There's a trail that goes along the North Rim there. I forget the name of it. And then connects up with the old Kaibab, which is at the head of Bright Angel Canyon. And then I went cross country from there over to the road down to, well, you know, the Walhalla Plateau road back to my car.
Right.
At Vista Encantada.
That's a whole amazing hike right there.
Yeah, it was an extended hike, and it was kind of, but you know, I wasn't. It was like, that's what I had to do, right?
Right.
It's no big deal.
You want to get on the trip, is what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. You leave your car, and, you know, you got to get back to it at some point.
Gosh.
So, but the interesting thing, Tom, was I had never been down this route, into Quaggan. And so it's quite an interesting route. I've done it a number of times since. And it actually, if you know where you're going, it's pretty straightforward, right? You have to be careful. But I left my car at near Greenland Lake and then hiked in out to towards a place called Etoko Point. And there's a way you can get down. I knew this from Butchert's notes, right? And he had described how to get down through the Kaibab and to the base of the Coconino, and then you could follow along there going out towards Butchert Butte, the very famous Butchert Butte,
yep,
named after Harvey. And before you got to Butchert Butte, you come to a saddle above the red wall. It's in the Supai, but it's above the red wall of Quaggan, and you can drop down there and then get all the way through the red wall.
Okay.
And I kind of started this hike in the late afternoon. Now, remember, my objective is to get to Quaggan Rapids, right? Because that was where
that
Doug was going to camp. Well, I was thinking I would get there that day or early the next morning.
Wow.
And I'm not sure exactly what time I left. I think it was probably like 10:30 or something a.m., right?
Yeah.
And but I did get snagged up in the red wall. And I remember I was thinking it was getting kind of late in the day, you know, the shadows were starting to fill in and I'm stuck in the red wall. I can't figure out how to get down. And at some point, I remember I had to drop my pack and down climb. And, you know, I had a Kelty backpack with an aluminum frame. And And I thought, you know, this is kind of dicey because if I'm down climbing, I'm not sure I can get back up this. And
Well, not only that, but typically down climbing in the red wall is difficult because you can't see. You can see your next move. Yeah, I'm going to drop my pack to the little ledge there, and I'm going to down climb to that ledge. But I don't know if I can climb back up. And once I'm on that ledge, can I keep going down?
yes, exactly. There, you know it very, as well as anybody else. It's a challenge, and even in the best of times, you know, when you have good route data, it can be difficult
Yeah.
to link these traverses and descents, you know, together so that you can effectively get through. And I remember I did a number of false starts. Tried to go down, come back up, and went somewhere else. Tried to go down. Eventually, I said, okay, I'm going to commit to this. I dropped my pack down a number of, you know, feet and down climbed something, and then went down. And eventually, it went. You know, the red wall went. And I mean, I've been up that route several times since then with Art, and it's not that hard, right? And
So you were a little
it's just
off.
that.
You were a little off route, but it was still busted up enough that it worked.
That's right.
Okay.
Exactly. But I wasted a lot of time, right? So I get to the bed of quag, and I'm still like 5 miles
Oh
from the
dear.
river, you know? And so I just started booking it down the creek, you know, and going as fast as I could. You know, I think, I don't know if we talked about boulder hopping in Wyoming, but I seem to remember talking about that with you last fall. But I talked about it with somebody over the last 6 months, and in my early days with Chris Beal, you know, we went to Wyoming, Wind River Mountains, and there was one day when we were hiking a valley near Bonneville Peak. There's no trail there, but there were just it was just a giant boulder field, you know, for like a mile or something. And by that time, we were so fit and we were so mentally attuned, you know, with our huge backpacks, and I'm talking 60, 70-pound packs, we were just literally skipping from boulder to boulder to boulder. And not skipping, but jumping and running, right? Moving fast. And, you know, you can do that when you're 20. You have those skills, that physical capability, and that, you know, that mental focus that allows you to integrate your movement with your strength. Anyways, the same thing happened on, you know, on this quaggin thing. I was able to call on almost a supernatural ability to fly down this creek, you know, which was a little disappointing because I like to see it. I like to see what I'm walking through more, you know. But eventually I got down to where the water starts up, the spring. And it was getting pretty black, and so I basically had to stop. You know, I knew I couldn't do this in the dark. So I thought, well, I'm only an hour and a half short of Quaggan. I know I can get up at the break of dawn, you know, and catch these guys because they're not gonna. It's gonna take them a few hours to break their camp, etc. So I wasn't too concerned. And then I camped where I camped. It was so fortuitous because the next morning, I woke up, you know, very early, and put my stuff together and threw it in the Kelty and started down. But at one point, I turned around and looked behind me, and I could look up at the horn of Hutton Peak, and it was illuminated by the rising sun. And this is just the most majestic alpine-like summit in the Grand Canyon, as far as I'm concerned. It looks like an alpine horn. It's not, obviously, it's not created by a glacial erosion, but it just has this perspective. And I don't know, it just had a big impact on me at that time. So I saw this peak and I was just entranced by it. I said, I have got to climb that peak. And you know, and I at the time, I think I'm assuming it was unclimbed at the time. But anyways, I ran down to Quaggan, and I get there, and there's nobody there. So,
Oops.
oh my God, what's going on? And you know, this time it's only like 8 in the morning, so I thought, I have to have beat them here, you know. And I thought, well, what if they camped a little bit downstream? And so I said, okay, I'll go downstream, I'll hike downriver, and if I come across their camp, I'll join them. And meanwhile, if they are coming down the river, you know, they have to pass me, right?
Right.
So there shouldn't be any problem here. So I started hiking, and I started hiking, and I was hiking, you know, really fast. And eventually, I got down to around 60-mile rapids. So this is like, I don't know, it's like 3 or 4 miles, you know, downriver. And I see a boat pulling out from shore. You know, it's a small boat with oars. And so I see this boat ahead of me pulling out from shore, and I thought, could that be them, you know? And so I go as fast as I can, and I start yelling to attract the boatman's attention, you know, and so I said, are you with Doug Rickard party? And the guy says, yes, we are. And it was somebody, Bill, what was his name? Bill and his wife, Leslie. And they were co-boaters with Doug.
Okay.
And that they had indeed camped there near 60 Mile Rapids that, you know, the night before. And they were just leaving, and they were the last boat to leave.
Oh, my gosh.
So I just barely made it, you know.
Wow.
And Fisher, Bill Fisher Bill and Leslie Fisher were their names. And so, of course, Doug had fortunately told them that I'd be joining the party. And so they welcomed me on their boat.
So did
eventually
he just,
caught up
did
with
he
the
just
rest of
forget
the group, you know?
To camp at Quaggan? Or did he get to Quaggan? You weren't there, so he kept going.
Well, it could have been that. No, I don't think Doug was really in charge of the group.
Okay.
And so I suspect that, I'll never know the details of this, Tom, but I suspect that the group just decided that they weren't going to camp at Quaggan.
Or
they had
somebody
gone to
missed
kill.
The pull-in and went on by, and then everybody else had to chase them. I mean, it could be any number of reasons. Yeah.
Could be any number of reasons, exactly. And I'm not sure that the other people were necessarily all aware that, you know, that this other guy, this hiker, was going to be joining the group, you know.
Wow, that was lucky. Gee.
I was very lucky, yeah, very lucky, because, you know, they had food for me and everything. Now, I would have made it out, of course.
Right.
I would just reverse my hike and gone out, you know, or come out in Anquip or something like that, you know.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have been the end of the world, but it was a close call, for sure.
Talk to me about the river trip, because I'm going to be curious to know, as your first river trip, what was it like and how did it compare with the other stuff you were doing in the canyon?
Yeah, well, it was definitely very neat. I have to say, it was very cool to see the canyon from that perspective, you know. And I remember sitting in Doug's boat most of the time, and there's a stretch down below Lava Canyon and down to like Tanner Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
And my remembrance of it, I don't know how accurate this is, but my remembrance was it was just a series of little tiny flutters in the water, you know, and it was just like the boat was just kind of shaking it, you know, as it went through these flutters. They weren't rapids, they were just gentle little things, you know, and like there was all this spray that was flying up and it was all lit by the sun, you know, and I just remember experiencing that water flowing by, this, you know, sparkling drops of water flying by, and having that perspective looking over the tube in the middle of the river, right? As opposed to being always on the side of the river,
right,
on the shore,
right,
and looking at the massive waves going by, or the, you know, the river gently and quietly coursing by, right?
Mm-hmm.
But being in it instead of, or on it instead of off to the side of it, you know.
Right.
And it was definitely a very positive experience. I would love to have done more river running. It's just that I needed to spend my time, you know, up in the side canyons. So it
which is interesting. Let's go through this, and I'll get to this in a minute. So you were able to link up with Bill and Leslie, and they got you on the boat, and you're at 60 mile, and you're pulling out. So I'm assuming you camped somewhere at Tanner or Umpqua or something like that for the night?
Yeah, it was in that vicinity. I can't remember the specific locality, but we did hike up to the ruin
Okay.
above Tanner, right?
So
So I'm
yeah.
assuming, yeah, we probably camped right there,
Okay.
and then we hiked up to that ruin, and I remember that was a fun thing. Most of the group went up there, right? And then.
So the next day would have been Gorge Day, and it would have been Hanse and Sucked Olives and Grapevine, maybe going to Phantom or Cremation, I don't know.
Yeah, quite honestly, Tom, I don't remember where we camped each night. I
Okay.
really don't remember. It was only like four, maybe 5 nights,
Right,
something like
you
that.
wouldn't have been with them long because
No.
they're making a kind of a circle there, or an arc, if you will, and you've joined at 60 mile, and the river's going to arc around to get to Tuna and Crystal. So that's 3 or 4, maybe 5 days at the most.
Yeah, it wasn't that long, and I have the actual dates recorded in my files,
Okay.
so I could say I could figure out, or we could find out which dates I was there,
So
but I don't remember the campsites,
what was
the
it
beaches.
like car camping on the river compared to carrying your house on your back?
Yeah, well, it was quite a contrast, and even back then. Compared to today, I'm sure the river running gear in the 1970s was very primitive, but even then, compared to what you had in your backpack, it was a godsend. I mean, they had these big stoves, and normally, if we had a stove, we would have either a Sella stove, which burned white gas in the early days, and then we graduated to these Blue A stoves, which were propane, right?
Okay.
And of course now I use butane stoves, and there's giant stoves, and they had their ice chests,
Right.
with their dry ice, and so they were pulling out frozen meat, and there were all these ice cold beers that to be had, and pop, and it was quite a different, totally different experience,
Right.
and quite honestly, like I was kind of prided myself on my ascetic
You had to be if you were a
philosophy.
backpacker.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so it was quite a contrast, but we had a great time, and I got along really well with all the people on that trip that I can recall anyways. And I think, some of them have passed on now. I think the Fishers have passed on. And there was another fellow, oh, they called him Back Eddie. Oh, I forget his name now. But anyways, he passed on, I think, in a river accident, actually. So anyways, at least Doug's still around, although I haven't chatted with him in many years. So, but yeah, I just I'm sure we went down, and I can remember, I can remember Hanse going through that. I don't remember too much of the other rapids in the gorge. I don't know. I guess just because, you're just in the boat, and you're going to do it. And I think, we definitely, I recall walking around Crystal,
Okay.
on the north side there. And then I was planning to leave them at Crystal, but I went down with them to Tuna. And I
Okay.
think, we camped there. Is there a campsite at Tuna?
There used to be, but not now.
Okay, well, what we did was we did camp there then, and Doug and I hiked up Tuna,
Okay.
and he went about halfway, and then I continued farther up, and I got up through all the schist, right, and then came back down, and then we went back to our camp. And interestingly, Tom, when I was on that little jaunt up Tuna, I found two dead bobcats
Oh, wow.
lying. Yes, lying in the creek bed, if like separated by several hundred meters of distances. And I've never seen a dead bobcat anywhere else in the Grand Canyon,
That's odd.
right? Yeah, it was very odd to come across these two different carcasses, and I kind of hypothesized that they maybe had a fight. They had somehow fought each other, and one of them was you know, well, they were both damaged and,
right.
and kind of slunk away and died their respective deaths, whatever. Mm-hmm. But
huh.
who knows what
huh.
it was. But
yeah.
it was just very peculiar to find that, you know. And
hmm.
and anyways, we camped at the mouth of Tuna. And the next morning, I walked back up Tuna, back up the river to Crystal.
Oh, wait a
and,
minute. Now, that, the, from Tuna to Crystal along the schist is a sporty little route.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, you know, you have to climb up at one locality, and it's pretty, you know, pretty exciting to go up there.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've done that since with Bruce Grubbs and Art. We've
okay.
subsequently done that hike at least one other time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was you know, I said goodbye to those guys at the mouth of Tuna. They went off downstream, and then I went back up Crystal, and it was the first time I'd been in the Crystal Creek drainage.
Okay.
So that was, you know, pretty exciting for me to go up there. And,
cool.
And, of course, from Harvey's notes and his books, you know, which, by the way, I would carry, you know, his Trex book.
Oh, wow.
In my backpack on these trips. I remember that because it got really beat up, you know, as it would. And, but, you know, it was like a little Bible that I would read each night. And you know, constantly reading different hikes that he had done and whatnot. So,
okay.
So I knew about the route up through up in Dragon Creek and up to Shiva Temple and out to Teo Point.
Okay.
And you know, it went very, you know, straightforwardly, and it was just like that was the end of the river trip. So it was like just, you know, finishing up the river trip, right? Even though it was a fairly major hike, and. And I got back to, you know, eventually I got back to my car by hiking the rim trails and the roads up there and went back down south at that point. So, yeah, it was a great adventure and a great introduction to river running. Unfortunately, I only had one other river trip that we can talk about at some point, but it was a similar trip. But I joined Doug and his party. Just upstream from, well, was supposed to join them just upstream from the gauging stations
okay.
at Phantom Ranch.
All right.
That's what Doug said. He said, we're going to be camped on a beach upstream from there. And, like, I don't know anything about river beaches or anything like that. But, and I said, okay, I'll meet you there then.
So what year was that second trip?
The second trip would have been like two years later or something like that.
So 77 or 78?
78, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that when we get to 78, or do you want to just put it in now?
Okay, let's talk about it at 78.
Okay.
Yeah, there's some interesting things there for sure.
All right.
So
the reason why I want to kind of separate these two out is I want to ask you, after this first trip, I mean, it took me... many trips in the winter, long trips, trying to hike summits from the river to realize that it just doesn't pay. the way to do summits is from the rim. You know, and it just took a long time to figure that out. Did you get a sense of that on that trip in 1975? Or was that going to happen later? Because you didn't become a river runner, you stayed a Grand Canyon hiker.
Yeah.
You know, coming in from the rim and exiting via the rim.
Yeah, yeah. At that time, I mean, when I did that river trip with Doug, my understanding of river running then was that very few people were going off the river.
Okay.
On their trip, you know, it was. Most trips, even private trips, you know, they could be leisurely, and they would do the occasional trip, like, you know, hike up to the Yonkar Ruins,
right.
Or, you know, hike up Deer Creek Valley or something like that, or up to Pete's Creek. But, you know, it wasn't like a lot of people that at least that I heard of, were actually trying to do summits and significant climbs from the river at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I know they do it now, you know, because it's a way to get hardware down into the canyon. you know, with without having to lug it on your back for many days. And so, but I think back then people weren't thinking in terms of that kind of exploration. You know, it was. I mean, I did hear about, you know, eventually guys from Flagstaff, is it Bain, George Bain?
Oh yeah.
You know, starting to do these hikes, these long hikes off the river, but we never really thought of it as a way to get to the summits, at least as a standard way to do it. Partly it's because, Tom, I didn't have access to the river trips. You know,
right.
I mean,
right.
if I had lived in Flag and knew the community and had the opportunity to jump on these river trips, I might have taken that approach. You know, like, for instance, climbing Nankoweap Mesa from the river is a significant bit easier than coming down from the rim.
Yes.
You know, but the actuality is there's a lot of climbs that it, you know, it does not make sense to do them from the river.
You're not going
to
do Hayden from the river. I mean, you
could.
You
are not going to do that.
You could,
yeah.
but it would take a couple of days, and you can do it in a day from the rim, as you mentioned. So there's a lot of named buttes, which are typically up at, you know, Kaibab, Toroweep, Coconino level, that getting them from the river is...
It's much more of a challenge.
It's, a, you know. Yeah, it's different.
Yeah. But, you know, then, you know, conversely, there's quite a few buttes. Like, think of, like, the Tabernacle, right?
Sure.
Which is down by, you know, west of Onkar Creek. Rapids there,
which is easy from the river, and then when you're there, you'll do Solomon and Sheba, as well. And if you want to break up through the Red Wall to climb Rama Shrine and Krishna Shrine and Vishnu Temple, you can do that. But what happens is if you're going to be doing summits like that day after day, you get worn to pieces, and coming in from the rim, you typically don't bite off, you know, that much in one go.
That's true. You don't.
So that's the other balance.
That's very true. And you know, so it's interesting you raise that point, because in our early trips, you know, the objective on these climbing trips was typically one butte. You know, it was kind of like climbing Mount Everest in the 1950s. You know, they had this mindset. It was like this military expedition that was all, you know, methodically planned out with all this logistical support, you know, to provide the supplies to the team, which would finally push onto the summit. And so the thinking kind of then was like, you know, we're going in to climb, you know, let's say Quaggint. You know, we've got to marshal all our thinking here to get down there, bring the right gear, you know, and the idea was you'd get up Quaggint and, thank God we made it out. Let's get out of here. Right.
You're going to do it in a long weekend, and you're not going to do it in 2 weeks from the river. Well, you can do it from the river. That can be done. But again, there's the number of named buttes that are closer to the river and lower down that you can get to. You know, just
it's definitely limiting. It's definitely limiting. But, you know, it does give you the opportunity to do things. And like my friend Jake Daly, I've never met Jake.
Uh-huh.
Maybe you know him?
Yeah. I don't know that I've met him. He's on the internet, a great guy, doing some great hikes, just some wonderful stuff. Young guy using a pack raft and doing some wonderful things.
Yeah. And so Jake has a stash of climbing gear, a big stash of climbing gear, down on the river near Grey Castle.
Okay.
And so there, you know, his plan is to, he was hoping to get a permit this spring, and he said he had three applications, and then all of them were denied. And so he's, you know, his plan is the next time he gets a permit, gets on a party, he's going to go down there, and, you know, they've got the gear there already.
Right.
And from previous floats, and well, he tried Grey Castle once, and it was pretty scary. So they needed to augment the gear.
Can you describe that butte for me, please?
Can I? I can send you a picture of
it
if you want.
No, just later. Just for the transcript. For this oral history, the people that are going to listen to this that aren't knowing what you're talking about. Can you describe that to me, please?
Sure. It's called Great Castle, and so it's a pillar basically of I think it's actually Temple Butte, Devonian limestone. This is sandy limestone, and
how about Bright Angel Shale?
Is it Bright Angel Shale?
It is.
Okay, well,
that's
then
what
I
makes
stand
it even harder.
Yeah, that's it. But it's really, really very friable. It breaks apart.
It's a dirt pile. It's a standing dirt pile.
Yeah, so I think it's about 80-100 feet tall.
Yeah.
It's on the east side of the river.
Yep.
And it's about halfway down from Nankoweap to Quaggan.
Yeah.
And in that's the general area. And the thing is, it doesn't show up on the topo maps. So, there's a couple of other buttes that have been formally named in the canyon, which have never been plotted on the USGS topo maps. So, it's looking at this thing, Great Castle, I would never climb it, except now it has a name,
Right.
And so once it becomes a named summit, then you have an additional interest in getting to it, getting up on it. But I think this is one I'll probably never try.
I mean,
myself.
It's a sort of deal where you want to take a crossbow and shoot a rope over the top of the thing and then pull through some climbing rope, some static line, and then try to anchor it and then try to work your way up the rope from one side to get to the top.
I think that's been tried, actually.
Okay.
I think that Jim Ullman tried that. Right. Have you interviewed Jim, by the way?
Not yet.
Not yet. Yeah, you'll have a great time with him, I'm sure. But,
yeah.
A climb like that is very well served from a river trip,
right?
Right, because you can bring down as much gear as you need.
Tie up
and
the
bring
boats.
It right to the base of the climb.
You're a quarter mile or less from the base of the climb. Yeah,
yeah.
That makes sense. But
yeah,
but I Wotan's throne. I mean, Freya, Vishnu. I mean, just start rattling off peaks that are Angel's Gate. You can do Newbury from the river. You can do Howland's from the river. There's some again. They're easy from the river, but Buddha and Zoroaster and suddenly it's like whoa! It starts slowing you down from the river.
Oh, it's for sure it does, and as you pointed out, you do a couple of these things, and they're extremely draining.
Right.
Even if you're doing it from the river, it's very demanding and physically demanding, and you can't just keep doing that, day after day after day. At least I can,
right?
And you need to refresh and relax. And I mean, that's one of the reasons I loved. Going up on the North Rim in the summer and doing summits from the rim because, you could spend a day going out to Hayden, for instance, and, it's pretty gritty, right? I mean, I talk about how beautiful it was on the climb, which is undoubtedly, the case. It was fantastic. But to get out there, you are sweating and getting your arms torn to shreds and sliding down these ravines and gullies that are just totally overgrown with vegetation, and it's a real mess and it's really fatiguing, especially if it's kind of cusp of summer, and it's getting warm. And the nice thing about the North Rim is you could retreat up to the cool pines and then take a day off,
right.
And go get a shower in the village and sit around on a picnic table and relaxing. Chewing the fat, about yesterday's climb and planning tomorrow's climb. It was very relaxing in that way.
Right.
And anyways, it just goes to show you that, it speaks to the difference of positions there, doing your climbing off the river and doing your climbing off the rim.
Right.
So
okay, so
I see the value in both, right? But I just really never had the opportunity to take advantage of the river.
Yeah, no, understood. All right, so 75... you summited Hayden, and you got on the river trip. Where else did you do that year?
Actually, 76. The river trip was in 76.
Okay.
Yeah, and I did a lot of hikes, right, in amongst these climbs, and like, you know, just covering the trails, right? Because I mean, that was exciting enough in its own right. And so, you know, I don't remember. I would have to go back to my detailed notes to get all the things that I did, the trips, the hikes. But the next big one of importance was, again, it was in this framework of climbing, right? Was in 77, and this was in, actually, it was, I think it started the last couple of days of 76 in December. And so I had been down on the Hermit Trail and then hiked the Tonto, you know, over to Indian Gardens there. And I'd looked down from the Tonto there, and I could see just east of Hermit that there was this beautiful fault ravine that you could get down to the river, right? And and then I also saw that there was the fault continued across the river, and there was a break in the Tapeats there to get you up to the Tonto. So that was in the back of my mind. I thought, well, that's kind of an access way to the North Rim, you know, in the winter when you know, that you can't drive into the North Rim, but you can get across the river if you want to float there. And we've been hearing about people floating, and Harvey had done that, so it was not unheard of. Anyways, it was in the back of my mind, but the problem with that is that you couldn't see any red wall ascent, right? I couldn't pick out a way to get up the red wall. If you went across the river and wanted to climb up, say, to Tower of Set, which is west of Trinity Creek, there was no way to get to the red wall that we could see. And so
That you could
you
see
probably
being the
know about
optimal word. Oh, yeah.
yeah, and so. So I started going through the list of unclimbed summits, right? At least what I thought was unclimbed, and I for some reason I settled on Horus,
Okay.
which is a long north-south oriented mesa, right?
Okay.
And on the west side of Trinity Creek.
And there's
And
four
so
buttes there.
I
There's Ra, Set, Osiris, and Horus.
yes, that's.
All together, all with the Egyptian heritage there. By Dutton, who named those buttes, and so there's a cluster of them, and they're all right there.
That's right, all right there. And at the time, except for Osiris, they were all unclimbed, right?
Really?
So
Okay.
that was kind of neat to think about, right? And so, but again, you know, we had this mentality that we could kind of only tackle one at a time, you know?
Okay.
And so I said to my friend Scott Kronberg, why don't we try Horus?
How do you
Now,
spell Scott's
Scott
last name?
Kronberg, KRONBERG.
Thanks.
And Scott and I had climbed in Yosemite and in
Okay.
Tuolumne Meadows in Yosemite Park in '76. We spent about 6 weeks over there, and we'd also climbed Shiprock together.
Okay.
And so we were, you know, we really got along well with each other, and I proposed to him that we do this winter trip
Were you still going
up
to the
to.
U of A then?
Yeah, I was still going to U of A. Yeah,
Okay.
yeah.
And did you know Scott from school? How'd you meet him?
I met Scott in Phoenix at, you know, at Desert Mountain Sports there at the
Okay.
climbing shop, and I think he participated in some of the climbs of the Arizona Mountaineering Club. So we just kind of, you know, I can't remember the first time I met him for sure, but we just hit it off, you know, and we liked climbing together. And I remember he was not always in Tucson. He did not live there. He did not go to school at U of A. I
Okay.
think he was doing his studies in Tempe. And but he would come down to Tucson once in a while, and we'd go climbing together. And of course, I was up in, my parents lived in Scottsdale, so I would be always going up to Phoenix, and you know, we could climb there too in Central Arizona. And we just got to be good friends. And so I suggested we try this trip together. And
Okay.
you know, this is back in the days. I mean, quite honestly, at that on this trip, which was a winter trip, so it was cold, right? Potentially it was going to be cold. I knew that. And I wore my mountaineering boots that I would normally wear to, you know, the Wyoming mountains.
Okay.
And that's what I hiked in. And
Wow.
we carried a tent, an A-frame tent that I had was made by a company called Holubar out of Boulder, and this big orange tent, you know, with external poles and a fly.
How do you spell
Holubar? Holubar.
Okay.
Yeah, they're out of business. Like, well, so many of those companies,
right.
They're bought up by Johnson & Johnson or something like that.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But we carried this big tent. You know, we had two ropes because we didn't know where we were going to be getting into.
And you needed a boat.
No, because, yeah, I'm getting it. I had mentioned that I had seen this route. But the problem is I knew you could get back up to the Tonto, but I couldn't see any way through the red wall,
okay.
Right? So, you know, I said, well, you know, it looks so tempting to go over there and just, you know, but you can't get up the main cliff. And so, you know, from that same position, you can look at the red wall on the east side of Tower of Set there. There's a peak, which is unnamed, and there's a long ridge that comes down from it.
Yep.
And it looks like it's broken enough
yep.
that you can get up it,
yes.
right?
Yes.
And so I thought, well, okay, we can't get across the river directly. That would be so cool if we could. We can, but we can't use that to get up to the through the red wall there. So I said, you know, let's. And probably I was perhaps also a little reluctant to get into one of these little boats on the river at that time because it was kind
yeah.
of creepy sounding.
Yeah.
And we decided that we would just hike in from Phantom Ranch.
Got it.
And so we hiked down to the Silver Bridge, and then we hiked downriver from there. You can get up onto the out of the gorge and follow along on the through the Precambrian,
right.
And then get over to 94 Mile Creek
yep.
And up above the Tepetes there. And where we camped, so we camped between 94 Mile Creek and Trinity on a saddle there.
Okay.
And so I think that took us the one day to get there.
Yes.
And
or
we had
two.
To go down 94 Mile or 91 Mile Creek, I guess, to get the water. I remember that. And because it was a dry camp.
Right.
But we could see Horace off to the west, right?
Yes.
And we're looking at this this red wall route. We had binoculars, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we had our binoculars with us, and so we're scanning across, looking over Trinity Creek, and you know we could see this red wall route, and it was a very obvious rock fall on the north side of this ridge, or a slope where you'd climb up the slope to about a third of the way through the red wall, and
right.
then you'd traverse along a ledge, and then you had to do some climbing, right?
Right.
And we couldn't really see what, So the next morning, we got up pretty early, I remember that, and did the approach and you know, slugged our way up through the red wall and got to the base of the climb. And it was harder than we expected, I have to say. And it wasn't like, you know, a Yosemite, you know, a difficult Yosemite climb. I don't want you to think that any of the climbs I've done have been at that level. But it was challenging, right?
Mm-hmm.
And definitely you needed a rope. And protection, and so climbing on the limestone there. So, so I led that pitch, and it was like 5'6" is my recollection. That's how I rated it at the time, and that got us up. It was only about 40 feet long, right?
Right.
You get up onto the ridge crest, and then you could pick your way kind of very gingerly up the ridge crest
itself.
That's
right. You go right up that fin. And
yes,
up to that little flat area with the little unnamed butte up there.
Right, right.
Yep.
And so we get to the top, and we're happy we got through the red wall. And we're coming along around the top of that butte, and you get to the notch between that unnamed butte and Tower of Set, and you've probably been up there.
Well, and the route's staring you in the face from southwest.
Yes, exactly. You look down that red wall going, and you can see the whole thing. And on top of that, there's all this trash there.
Yep.
From surveyors and whatnot. So
it was from the tramway builders in 1923
exactly,
or whatever.
Exactly, but we knew nothing about that.
Okay, interesting.
Nothing about that. I didn't know anything about that. And so it was such a surprise to look down that you know, red wall ravine and see the obvious route.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, we knew we couldn't see any reasonable route through the Supai on the east side of Horus. So we followed the top of the red wall all around to the west side.
Oh, wow.
And eventually we could see a route that looked reasonable. But by this time, it was getting pretty late in the day.
Were you carrying your packs and your tent and all that stuff?
No, we had left the tent.
Okay.
We left the tent, so we just had climbing gear.
Okay.
You know, we had our ropes, two ropes, our racks, food, and we would have had parkas because, you know, our down jackets,
right, and whatnot, it was cold.
Because it was
sure.
cold, and mittens and stuff like that. But we had left the camp set up in that saddle.
Okay.
And so we followed the red wall rim around. Could see that, you know, where we could get up through at least the lower parts of the Supai on the west side of Horus, and started, you know, said, well, we're gonna have to bivouac here because we're obviously not gonna make it
right
up the summit and then back to camp. It's 4:30 in the afternoon on a winter day,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So we found this nice little overhang, you know, in the lower band of Supai there, and just decided to settle in there, and there was a big dead juniper tree, you know, a few tens of meters down the slope.
Okay.
So we actually, you know, pulled that thing up to our little ledge, our overhang, and broke up into chunks with the idea of making a fire, mm-hmm. you know. Now, I don't know, that's probably the last time I made a fire, actually, in the Grand Canyon. I can't remember.
In 76, the fires were banned in the winter, well, anywhere, in the winter or summer, on backpacking trips. Right about that time.
Yes, exactly. So we knew that we were, you know, breaking the law, but we figured nobody's going to see us where we're at, you know, and we need it, right? And, you know, we didn't absolutely have to have it. We could have survived without it. But the, you know, I remember that the sun dropped. It got dark quickly and fairly cool. And, you know, Scott and I, we eventually started this fire up after a couple of hours. And, you know, you're kind of bivouacking. You're just dozing and waking up shivering, you know, and then you kind of warm up a little bit and then you throw something else on the fire. And anyways, you just kind of get through the night that way. But in the middle of the night, it starts snowing.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was just so mystical to look out, you know, because we were under an overhang, so we were protected. It wasn't a huge one because it was just enough room to basically sit there. Mm. And there was a little fire at our feet that we kept going in. So the fire was providing a limited amount of light. And you'd look out and you could see the snow coming down on the other side, you know, just outside of the our overhang. And it was just really, really a neat visual sensation, you know, to see that. And we were sitting there, and sometime in the middle of the night, we hear this, and we could feel this rumbling start. And what happened was, in the embayment below us, apparently a big chunk of red wall must have collapsed in one of the, you know, in the embayment that was down the hill from us.
Yeah.
And because there was some amount of moonlight in between snow squalls, and we could see all this dust.
Oh, wow.
Billowing up from down below. And it was just like, wow. You know, how often do you ever actually see a rock fall in the Grand Canyon?
Right.
You know, I mean, I've seen the evidence of rock fall many times, but actual seeing a rock fall is pretty rare. And this one, we didn't actually see the rock fall. We just saw the dust coming up, from below. And it was like illuminated in this ethereal moon glow, you know, with occasional snowflakes blowing in front. It was just really kind of a neat night, you know, so we had a great time in that bivouac, and then the next morning got up, and at that point the sun was coming out. You know how a Grand Canyon winter storm can be, you know, you get a little bit of snow and then the sun comes out and it's brilliant and it all burns off.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we started up pretty early and did some climbs. There was a couple of technical climbs to get through the lower slopes of the lower cliffs of the Supai, and then that we eventually got up to the saddle between Set and Horace, and then we went and walked over to Horace, which was our primary objective, and scoped out a route on the south end, and it was on the west side of the south end.
Okay.
And it was in total about 100 and I don't know 100 to 120 feet in total length, and that we split into two pitches. And so I remember I got to lead the first pitch, and it was a very compact, like almost a chimney. We call it a sentry box. It's kind of like an open book. It's a corner, right?
Yeah.
And so it was a corner with a crack in the back of it, and you could kind of, you know, wedge yourself up with your back on one side and your feet on the other side, holding on into this crack with your hand. And it was like that for about 20 feet. And then there was a little horizontal ledge that I got on top of. And I knew that I had to, if I traversed to the left, I could get into a very nice corner at the base of a long, open book, which is basically a wall on one side and an opposing wall on the other side that are like 120 degrees separated, right? And with a big crack in the back. And it looked very easy from that point on. I just had to get, you know, over this ledge and into this little corner. And so I'm balancing on this ledge, and there's a huge boulder right on the ledge with me, you know, and it's basically the top of it is at my crotch, right? And I'm having to kind of balance and slowly kind of try to tiptoe around, in my huge mountain boots, by the way, tiptoe around this boulder on this little ledge. And, I mean, there was good protection. I had good protection in there, I know that. But when I was, like, just about past the boulder, I somehow grabbed it with my shirt or my gear or something, and it started to roll. And it actually rolled right across my foot.
Oh, wow.
And then went crashing down, almost, you know, almost hitting Scott down below. And it was so scary and unexpected that you don't really think about the consequences, right, at the time. But obviously I was okay because I kept my balance while that boulder rolled past me over my foot. And Scott's saying, "Are you okay? Are you okay?" I'm fine. I'm fine. So I continued around that corner and got into secure space for a belay, and then I brought him up, and then he led the next pitch, and then it was a very easy walk from there to the summit, right? So it was pretty exciting, but a fairly routine ending to the climb, and to try and. Well, there's more to the story, but I'll tell it all in order.
Yeah,
you know?
Please.
And so we wandered around on the top of Horace, you know, and unfortunately,
it's big and flat up there.
It is flat. Have you been up there?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's several routes up there now, and this was my first introduction, this summit, to the Bradford Washburn.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Mapping program, right? Because he was flying around in helicopter to many of these summits and doing detailed topographic mapping. And so on top of Horace, there was all this detritus, you know, from his surveys.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple of big orange plastic balls and some metal tripods, or maybe they were wooden, I don't remember. It wasn't a whole lot of stuff, but it was obvious gear, right? Yeah. And I think I seem to recall that we even saw skid marks for a helicopter, right? So it was kind of a letdown because you think you're doing a first ascent and then you find all this gear up there.
Yep.
It's still a first recorded ascent because those guys didn't climb it, right?
Right.
But, you know, it's not very pristine. But anyways, we got over it. It was no big deal.
Okay.
And I remember we walked the length of the summit. It's very narrow, as you know. We walked the length of it on one side and then came back, along the top of the other side, west side, and then rappelled down our route, or very close to it. And then there was two rappels to get us down to the red wall on the east side of Horace. And so the first one was a relatively short one. I think it was one rope, but we had to use both ropes. These would have been 150-foot ropes in a huge rappel, 150-foot rappel, to get down through the second cliff of Supai.
Okay.
And so, but that was fairly quick, you know, to get us down. And we're at this time we're fairly close to our return route, right? Because we're on the east side of Horus. But we get down to the Supai, and we kind of work our way down to the top of the red wall, and here's constructed trail here. You know, what is going on? We had no idea what this was all about.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you find a trail that you've never heard about before in the Grand Canyon, you know, you definitely want to follow up on it. So we dropped our packs with our climbing gear. And we walked north on this trail for about a mile or a mile and a half.
Cool.
And you know, as you know, it's the surveyor's trail. And at the end of this trail where it started to peter out, we actually found a stash of gear there. And believe it or not, in this gear stash there was a number of flares, and we actually were able to light one of the flares. It was something else, you know, that this stuff, we had no idea what the vintage was, but obviously it had been there for quite some time,
yeah.
You know, 80 years, something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're wondering if it's an old prospector or, you know, it's a pretty fancy trail and there's a lot of equipment. Anyways, it was really kind of neat to stumble on all this and, you know, old ceramic pots and pans, you know, that were there and frames, I think, for pack horses or mules,
yep,
you know.
Yep.
And anyways, you know, eventually we had to leave because we're running out of time. And we worked our way back south along this trail to that notch and where the surveyors had their camp on top of the red wall.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were going to actually, you know, the plan was that they would put a pylon on top of the red wall there, and that would be where the tram would come across.
Right.
We didn't know that anything about that at the time. We just knew that somebody had been exploring in there. And,
right.
And then we went down that red wall route, thank
okay.
God. It was there. It went so easy, you
yes.
know. And then we followed the Tonto back around and got into our camp, you know, well after dark. And so it was one of these, probably like 10 o'clock or something like that. I don't remember the exact time. But we crawled into our tent, and we're pretty beat, you know, because we'd had that bivouac the night before.
Right.
And I pull off my boot, right, my mountaineering boots, and I look at my left sock, and it is just totally soaked in blood.
Oh,
I mean,
geez.
It was just unbelievable. And I, you know, I carefully took the sock off and looked at my toes, and there was just blood everywhere and a couple of really big cuts. Of course, by this time it had dried, you know, because my shoe had been, you know, my foot had been in my boot for since that rock had rolled over it all day
right.
long, but I could see that it was a very close call, you know, because if that rock had gone a little bit different angle, and if I had not been wearing those heavy
yeah.
duty mountaineering boots,
no kidding,
you know, I would have had a broken foot,
wow.
which would have required
yeah.
evacuation.
Yeah,
and you know, and it's like this was not an easy place to get out of, you know.
No.
I mean, sure, I could have bundled up in on, you know, on the ledge on Horus, but Scott would have had to reverse our entire route
right.
all the way back to Phantom Ranch
right.
before he could get help, you know. So it was a good lesson in wilderness climbing in Grand Canyon,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
You can't be too careful, and you can't be too prepared
right.
for sure. So yeah. Anyways, it was a great trip, and that was kind of I think that Horus trip was the beginning of
so
you know,
was
a
that
real
your first
me.
First ascent then?
No, Brady was the first.
Brady was ascent. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, and then but Horus would have been the next one.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. I'd have to look at the details of my notes, but I'm pretty sure that's the way it went, and then Ra and Set. So to complete that and Osiris, we did that, but that was not the first ascent.
Right. So did you do Ra and Set that same year, or did you come back later?
Yeah. So let's see. Raw was in May, and Set was in October.
Okay, you know what?
So,
Let's do here. We've been going for about an hour and 20 minutes, not quite.
Wow.
Let's stop here, and we'll pick up with Raw and Set. And this is
Okay.
1976.
No, we're up to 77 now.
Oh, 77. Okay, that's right.
Yeah,
1976,
the Horace.
77. Yes, that's right. You
Yeah,
said
yeah.
December into January. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay,
Okay,
awesome.
sure. Well, I hope this, I
Cool.
hope I'm not spending too much time on this, Tom.
If you were, I would be chivying you along.
Okay,
But since
okay,
I'm not,
okay.
you can tell it's going just fine.
Okay, all right.
This is great.
I guess as long as you have tape,
Exactly. Lots of
I
tape. We're
can
good.
talk.
We're good.
Yeah.
Okay.
All
Well,
right.
with that, let's wrap up part four of A Grand Canyon Oral History with Jim Haggart. Today is Sunday, February 14th, 2021. My name is Tom Martin. Jim, thank you so very much.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Tom. I really enjoy it. Really enjoy it.
Hang on.